This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Today is going to be, it's a caffeinated day.
I do need coffee. I do need coffee.
Been rough.
Okay. Are we starting that over, or what are we doing?
Hello, hello. Welcome back to She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time. This season's theme is places we've called home, which means we are sharing the stories of ladies that are from or have lived in places that we have called home. Whether we've lived there for a decade, 2 months, or 2 weeks, places that were home to us, or in some cases, places where we've received mail. Today, we will tell the story of Olive Frances Chaudhin, the youngest registered architect in the state of New York. I'm Jessica Rogers, reminiscing about my Syracuse adventures getting half-price sushi from Sakanaya, coming to you from Miami, Florida.
Hey there, I'm Lizzie Rahr, missing recess coffee in San Francisco.
And I'm Nurjiti Rivas, remembering how much I enjoyed drinking a Cesar Chavez at Strong Hearts from Houston, Texas.
All right. It's time for our disclaimer. The three of us are not historians, nor are we experts on this subject. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find about each woman. If we get our facts a little mixed up, please forgive us. Leave us a comment and we'll all continue learning together.
All right. So listeners, when talking about a season dedicated to places that we've called home, we cannot forget such a pivotal time for us as college. Naturally, I've spoken about my hometown, so next we would be choosing a lady that attended Syracuse University, our alma mater, right? So let's get into it.
Let's go Orange!
All right. So Syracuse University started in 1870, and 3 years later, the architecture department would become established. Interesting fact, Syracuse would be the first university to offer architecture as a 4-year degree.
Oh, trailblazers. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Really, Jessica? 4, not 5? How many was the average for other schools, do you know?
Well, I can't speak for the other schools, but what made Syracuse the first was that it was a 4-year bachelor's of architecture degree. So 4 versus 5, meh. I think that that's probably based on any of the accreditation that needed to happen once we had like a formal accreditation board. So
I think the five-year program kind of came later, not when it first started.
Okay.
In 1898, Syracuse's School of Architecture would have its first female graduate by the name of Frances Whipple Bigelow.
Like the tea.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the tea's good. It feels like there's a Frances theme going on today.
Well, if it was, it went, because that's where the story ends.
Oh, okay. Theme over. Congrats, Frances Whipple Bigelow.
Yep. So, if you paid attention at the beginning, Najiti, I'm actually telling a story on a completely different chick.
I know. That's why I was like, there's a lot of Frances going on.
Yes. But this girl, her middle name was Frances. I'm going to be telling the story of all of Frances, not Frances Whipple. I just need to mention Frances Whipple Bigelow because she is from our alma mater. And even if it was like a 5-second story, this is all the information I could find of poor Frances, all 4-ish minutes of it. So there you go.
Okay, so originally you thought this episode would be about Frances, but you couldn't find more information than what you just told us, her graduation date.
Yep.
It's a sad day. It would be great to learn more about Frances, but I guess I'm glad that we're at least acknowledging her. Like,
yeah, shout out to Frances.
Shout out to Frances.
Exactly. I mean, I really tried to make it a story about Frances, especially because she's a Syracuse alum. But yeah, listeners, this is part of the behind the scenes stuff that is so stressful about researching, let alone not finding info of the little details that you want, but just finding information in general to make a story.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad because sometimes you just find a name and a brief description of a lady and you're like, ooh, she sounds cool. She sounds interesting. But then that's all you can find.
Yeah, it does get rough and frustrating at times, but we fight the good fight and persevere.
True.
Yeah, usually when I research, it's whatever I can find online, either online or books or websites, whatever, etc. But this time I even contacted Syracuse University themselves. And still no dice. Yeah. So listeners, if you are related to Frances for some chance, contact Syracuse University to give them some information and contact us because we are very curious about this lady.
Wow. You went straight to the alma mater source and nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I'm proud of you. And I'm glad that they answered because sometimes we don't get answers. So thank you, Syracuse.
That's true.
I mean, hopefully it changes soon that someone is going to find more information about Frances and we can revisit this story.
Agreed. Amen.
All right. So to our not originally scheduled, but became scheduled programming, our story begins on November 24th, 1904. Olive Chawden was born in New Utrecht, New York. Her father was John G. Chawden, a structural engineer.
So New Utrecht is a town on Long Island, and it was established by the Dutch back in the 1650s. Eventually, when New Amsterdam becomes New York and it expands, the city of New Utrecht essentially becomes absorbed into what is now Brooklyn in 1894. And so New Utrecht is specifically the neighborhoods of Bath Beach, Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, Borough Park, Dyker Heights, and Fort Hamilton. So, in conclusion, Olive was from Brooklyn.
All right. So let's fast forward to high school. Olive would graduate from Jamaica High School at the age of 15.
Man, ladies be graduating high school early this season. Remember Gertie at 14 and now Olive at 15?
Yeah, holy moly. Yep. These ladies are smart and very determined.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were. So Olive's initial plan was to attend Columbia University to study architecture, but they rejected her because she was too young. So Olive would wait until she turned 16, so a year later, to apply to attend to Cornell University, which allowed 16-year-olds to attend.
Okay, now I'm curious to revisit episode 71 and figure out the timeline of events here because I remember Cornell turned down Gertie Bessosa Silva because she was too young at 14 and then they didn't let her in until 4 years later.
Okay, so I'm going to bring this up at the wrap up.
Yes, it's very interesting. I think I even mentioned on episode 71 that for some reason, like just 16 feels older. I wonder if Gertie could have gotten in when she was 16, but like maybe she didn't reapply yet or something. I don't know. But
true.
Okay. But Jessica, so this is a Cornell episode, not a Syracuse one. That's what you're telling us.
Yeah. So we're talking about Cornell, ladies. It's the closest I could get to Syracuse.
After that whole let's go orange thing I did.
I still bleed orange, so.
Of course.
We're just giving Cornell a bone.
Okay. I mean, wow. Upstate New York was home to us for 5 years, and Cornell is in upstate New York. So there you go. Olive is our homegirl from Cornell.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Upstate
Nothing
New York.
Nothing but love.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cornell and Syracuse are only an hour apart. So
yeah,
we will allow it.
Yeah. So Cornell is, we are talking about Cornell, and Olive is our new homegirl. It's actually really interesting to learn a little bit about the university's history and how academia was in general, because this period in Olive's life was when the U.S. had designated Cornell to be a land-grant university, which means that they received funds from the government, but they had to follow whatever government rules they had. So, for example, back in 1890, universities that were in the former Confederate states had to show that race was not a criteria for admission. So in Olive's case, Cornell would be one of the first universities once it started to admit women.
Because they had to, is what you're saying.
Because they had to. Yeah.
Well, we'll take it. I mean, I'll take it.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm just clarifying.
Gotcha. I do wonder how many universities were a part of this program.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I was wondering, so is that they always had to accept women from the start, or was it a recent thing? Like they signed up for this land grant university thing or whatever.
Well, I did read that Cornell was the only Ivy that accepted women when it started. So Columbia was actually the last of the Ivies to accept women. So maybe in Olive's case, it wasn't so much that she was too young as to why they rejected her, but because she was a woman, or maybe both. You know how this goes. But to answer your question, Arjiti, the list of universities and colleges becoming a land-grant institution, it would change and evolve as different laws were placed by the government. Today, there are probably around like 130 institutions that are under this system. The majority on the list are public universities, and only a handful are private universities, such as Cornell.
I had no idea about any of that. Thank you for educating me today.
We've been learning, not just about our latest.
You know.
So Olive is attending Cornell, which was and is a 5-year program. Well, I mean, I guess maybe when it started, it was a 5-year program, to go back to our earlier comment about 4 years and 5 years or whatever.
Who knows?
Who knows? So at the age of 19 in 1925, Olive would graduate from Cornell with her bachelor's degree in architecture. Olive did it in 4 years instead of 5.
I mean, she graduated high school at 15. So are we that surprised? But I mean, true. Still, dang, Olive.
I think I'm still surprised because college is a whole new ball game than high school. True. And to deal with all of that at such a young age, though, I wonder if because of her age difference with her classmates, she didn't have opportunities to socialize as much as we did in college. And she just stuck to studying her butt off. So maybe that's how she got through it, which sounds very on brand for her. Okay, I've talked myself out of the surprise, actually. I'm not surprised anymore.
You know, Najdi, I actually thought of that aspect. Like, maybe because of her age, she couldn't do all of the socializing. Like, she just wasn't allowed to do it. Or maybe she wasn't interested in it. She's like, from the age of 16, she was like, I'm gonna get it done. Well, anyway, no surprise. Not only was Olive graduating early, she would also be the only woman in her graduating class.
Of course. Okay.
But but she wasn't the first woman to graduate with an architecture degree from Cornell, right?
Right. She was not. The first was Margaret Hicks. She takes the crown. So future episode alert. Woo! Margaret Hicks. And I know she's been on our list for a while, on our list of ladies to talk about. So I'm sure we will talk about her at some point. So we will fast forward to 1929 when our girl Olive is 24 and she becomes a licensed architect. She would be the youngest to do it.
Yeah! Way to go, Olive.
This lady is the youngest at everything.
Oh, yeah. Olive was really impressive. It seems like in most rooms that she was in, she would be either the first, the only, or the youngest.
A trailblazer through and through.
I'm telling you. Mm-hmm.
All right. So I kind of jumped the gun. I was just so excited about her. But I need to talk about a little bit of what happens before she actually gets licensed. In 1926, Olive would work at the firm Richard T. Childs in Mineola, New York. And then 2 years after that, in 1928, Olive would start her own firm based out of Garden City, New York.
Woo! Do your thing, Olive.
So she becomes licensed in 1929. In 1938, Olive would become the first woman to be admitted to the Brooklyn chapter of the American Institute of Architects. And for many years, Olive would be the only woman member.
Not surprising, but as always, such a bummer that that's the case.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Olive's specialty was residential design, right? That was her thing. Her style was neo-Tudor. Apparently, Homegirl had a style during this time, which I'll be sure to include in the show notes. It's a very, I guess, pop-in style at the time. She would design all these homes all over New York. And eventually, she even designed her very own house that still exists today. Her house that we can go check out is located at 104 11th Street in the Garden City area of Long Island, New York. It's described to have a distinctive weather vane showing her silhouette astride a T-square.
Okay. Well, that... the design of the weather vane is really getting me. Like,
yep.
On a T-square. I want to plan an arc venture here. Stat.
Same.
Yes. Okay, so Olive's work was also described as distinctive homes for people of moderate means.
I love that description.
Does that mean that we can afford her work?
One would hope. Yeah.
Depends. It depends on what you think, if you think your means are moderate.
I hope so, at least.
Well, I don't know, but I think with inflation right now.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know that I qualify as moderate, but
yeah, I don't know if these we'll get into it a little bit later. But OK, so point is, moderate means Olive was killing the game. OK, she was so amazing that she was invited to design a house for the 1939 World's Fair, which was held in New York.
Yes. OK, I know way less about this World's Fair, so. If anyone knows, but it still seems like that would be a huge accomplishment to get invited to be part of it.
I mean, it's been a while since the World Fair made an appearance on our episode, because I remember for a while they just kept showing up. And
yeah, but it was always the same one, right?
No, we had a few different ones. I mean, there's one that made lots and lots of appearances. But
sure. Yeah.
They went on break. I'm glad that we got one back. Welcome, World Fair.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Okay, but I've been trying to find Olive's work at the World's Fair, but all I could find was that her name was included as a quote-unquote contracted architect. Hmm. So, list of architects, Olive's name was in it. So, I couldn't find that, but it was interesting to also read about this World's Fair itself, because I don't think we've talked about this one. Like, we've talked about Chicago. Might have talked about Montreal, but I don't remember talking about New York. But Anyway, this would be the first exposition to be based on the future, allowing visitors to look at the quote unquote world of tomorrow. It was also the second most expensive American World Fair of all time.
Oh,
wow. I mean, after that description, I was hoping for lots and lots of pictures, floor plans, master plans, elevations, perspectives, all the things of Olive's work.
Yeah. It's like a really big bummer that you couldn't find more. But I think I still stand by what I said, that it's great that she's listed as an architect on the project, because we know that could definitely have gotten erased. So, but it shows that she was accomplished and well known in the area at that time. OK, but like, let's talk about how expensive was it and which one's the most expensive?
OK, so I don't know which one's the most expensive, but this one, it was $28 million. So that's already a
lot. At that time.
I didn't even calculate how much that is today.
Yeah.
Also, that was only recorded in private bonds to create the fair. So and that means that was only like 1/3 of their overall budget.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's a lot of money. It was also just really interesting to learn about this stuff. Like I definitely got sucked into the rabbit hole. But Olive, I'm telling you, she was popping. Okay. So after the World's Fair and stuff, you know, she's on Long Island. She is doing her thing. She's basically designing neighborhoods. But like, I'm not talking about like urban planning. Like, I'm not talking about that. Like, I'm talking about like kind of like the developer side, you know? She's designing house by house right next to each other in the span of a neighborhood, like neighborhood blocks.
Oh. Like suburbs?
Yeah, pretty much. But early suburbs, they got big plot
before
land.
Before suburbs were suburbs.
Exactly. Now, each house was meant to sell for $12,000.
Is that the moderate price? Because I think I can afford that.
Yeah, right. How much is that worth now? Like,
yeah, that'll help determine how moderate she really is.
Yes.
Okay. So Google tells me that it's roughly around 260,000.
Oh, so, that's great. Actually, right?
So take it right now.
Sign me up.
Yeah, Olive was designing for those of moderate means like us.
Hey, hey. Yes, we learned that we are moderate.
We sure are.
As I mentioned earlier, Olive had her design style, okay? Neo-Tudor. Programmatically, she would also include a formal breakfast room in her designs, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's very ahead of her time. This became really common, and today the breakfast area is still one of the most used spaces in a house, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at my aunt's house, I barely ever eat in the dining room. It's all about the breakfast area. And we just sit and hang there too. Forget the living room. Let's just do everything at the breakfast area.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Less and less people are asking for formal dining rooms. They just want one eating place that's sort of like in the middle of everything.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Okay, so for Olive, one of the houses that wasn't moderate means that she built was actually a mansion for a distiller. And it was featured in the 1935 Good Housekeeping magazine.
I am really digging all of this good press and recognition that she's getting.
Amen.
Yeah. I wonder what was the client distilling? And also, you think they paid her in money and alcohol? Because that'd be cool.
Oh, hey.
Food for thought.
Yeah, they didn't mention that part.
Food for thought.
Booze for thought.
Yeah. Hey.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So, Olive, she was essentially building during the Great Depression and the start of World War II. So, needless to say, her work became less and less elaborate
and basically the amount of work coming in was less and less.
I mean, that makes sense. Was she at least able to continue finding work, though? Maybe other project types, since she'd been mostly doing private residences?
Well, it sounds like she was doing better than other ladies that we've talked about during this time. But I'm curious as to what she did next.
Yes. Okay. So if you recall episode 72, when we talked about Marion, you know, my homegirl from Miami, she would move to Florida around the 1930s and 40s because Florida was going through this big building boom. So word must have spread to Olive as well, because in 1943, Olive moved to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, just about 45 minutes to an hour north of Miami.
Oh, this lady is connected to you all over the place.
Mm-hmm. This is so cool. I'm glad that you're finding all these connections.
Yep, that's right. Picking it up as they're, I'm putting it down. But so shortly after moving to Florida in 1945, Olive would marry a fella by the name of Carl G. Johnson.
Dun, 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 dun. Here comes the bride.
Here comes the bride.
And then she became a bride again, because I couldn't find that much info on this husband.
What?
But I will say that, yeah, I couldn't find info on the wedding of Carl G. Johnson, but I know that Olive gets married again to another guy by the name of Rawell Van Sickle.
Wait, what? Polygamy?
Oh, I've always wanted to watch a show about brother husbands. So this okay. would do it.
So she was very ahead of her time.
Sit tell me.
Progressive in the world okay. of polygamy.
Wow.
So if what you're saying is true, then I would also be connected to Olive, not because of the brother husband's part, but because it reminds me of like my fascination of like a reality TV shows and like Sister Wives, because I love watching reality TV, and Sister Wives is one of them. Nerjity, also to answer your other question, there is a show on TLC about brother husbands, speaking of.
Oh, but really? But I like the HBO show. I want to see a drama. Not, I don't like reality TV like you guys do.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't. I don't know. It's either going to be a reality TV show or a documentary. But
she wants big love, no. brother big husband's love. Edition.
Yes. Exactly.
Bigger love.
Bigger love. No. But also, what to we are not talking about polygamy.
Yeah, wait, oh. We went on a big polygamy tangent. Yeah. You've never answered the question as to whether Olive becomes a polygamist.
I'm guessing no. I thought this was all a joke.
No, it was.
Okay.
I was just talking about, like, if it was true, this is more ways that we're connected because of a hot mess this is and how I love to witness hot messes on reality TV. But... all right. So when I tried to look into this first husband, I couldn't find anything. So my guess is that she does get married to Carl. Something happens. He dies or they get divorced. And then Olive marries this other guy afterwards, Rawell Van Sickle. And this is the guy that she stays with for a long time. So... no polygamy, traditional, you know, I do till death do us part or divorce.
Well, she wasn't that traditional because she kept her last name. So she's also progressive in that area, it sounds like.
She is and she isn't, because Johnson doesn't make it into her in the research, like her last name, but Sickle does.
Oh, so okay.
But it's not consistent. So maybe she was progressive, or maybe my researchers were more progressive and didn't include her last name.
I see. Okay.
But anyway, so Olive is married once or twice, first or second, not together, not a throuple, but she's in Florida.
Okay.
And And while in Florida, I couldn't find that much on her work per se, but I know that she designed a lot of garden apartments. I do know that while she was in Florida, she would become most known for being the program director and board member of the Museum of Fine Arts in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, program director sounds fancy.
I wonder what the salary is for that. Can I earn more as a museum director than an architectural associate? I should look that up later. Was she a moderate means arts program director?
I mean, I don't know what how much she was getting paid there, if it was moderate or not. But I know for today, I mean, I've looked it up and yeah, it's a little bit more than moderate. So it's a good thing. I will say, though, that I think the folks that are museum directors, they usually have to have a degree in like museum studies. So
never too late.
Yeah.
Don't trample never my dreams. I can go back to college.
No, there's still you can still do it. There's actually online colleges that have programs like that because I've also looked into it. But anyways, fast forward to 1981. When Olive's alma mater, Cornell University, named the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning after her.
Whoa. Okay. That is huge, I feel like. And she was alive to see it happen?
Yeah.
Wow. So wait, but I didn't know their school is named Olive Tiada. I don't remember that when I went to visit.
It's probably called like the Chauden Building or something. That's how I.
Wild.
Well, yeah, I think that she's still alive because Jessica hasn't deceased her yet. So she lived to see
deceased this happen. Her.
She ain't dead yet.
But seriously, this feels like such a well-deserved and high honor. Like, I have to say it. This makes me respect Cornell more. Good job, Cornell. That's all I'm going to say about that. I hope that all Cornelians learn about Olive and are super proud their school is named after her.
That's right.
Yes. So on March 15th, 1997, at the age of 92, Olive would pass away.
Now she 92. Deceased her. Now she 92. Deceased her.
Yeah, okay.
Now I deceased her. Just
not say deceased her. That sounds so weird.
I don't think it's grammatically
That's
correct
why I
either.
I say not. But okay, 92. That is a long life. And it sounds like she got a lot of deserved recognition while she was still alive for all of her work.
Yeah, her story has been really inspiring today. And I hope that I get to live as long as she did and do great things just like her. You know, I'm kind of sad that we didn't learn about the other Frances today, but a little bit glad because we got to learn about Olive. Thank you for sharing her story, Jessica.
You're welcome. Yeah, I feel like I know a lot about Olive's story, and it makes me really curious about Frances, the Syracuse alumna story, just because I wonder what she did after she graduated. Olive, I know that even though, like, once she passed away, a lot of the money that she had, she donated it to Cornell afterwards. Oh, so
cool.
Maybe that's also why she's the bomb diggity, because she like gave back to the school.
Yeah.
Can't speak for Frances because I don't know squat about her. I know that there's no buildings named after her. So, you know, just saying, unless Syracuse, contact me. You have her email. Just tell me something. But anyway, so Olive, you know, she was pretty cool. She would design over 400 homes. It was rumored, and I have to say rumored, because it came up in my research that the mayor of Long Island would rename the Garden City neighborhood to Chauden City. But I couldn't find out if that, like, still exists today. It just came up. I couldn't, like, if it still exists, I don't know. Another cool thing that I didn't mention was that at some point she served as an inspector for the Federal Housing Administration and as a member of the Board of Ethics for Architects for New York State.
Okay, but she maybe had a town named after her? That's kind of cool.
Yeah, this lady, right. Achievements on accolades, on recognitions, on achievements, on towns. It's like a huge achievement sandwich.
Yes. She probably has a sandwich after her, too, somewhere.
Maybe.
But, right. Girl was awesome. So now that brings us to the second half of our episode, the caryatid. So, Nerjity, can you remind us what a caryatid is?
Sure thing, chicken wing. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. For each episode, we'll choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering the profession through their work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode.
Okay, so this week's caryatid goes to... Renee Kemp Rotan!
Renee!
Yeah! Okay, so I'm really excited to talk about this week's caryatid because Renee, she would be the first African-American female to graduate from Syracuse University in 1975.
Yay! Woo! Congrats to Renee.
Yeah, how cool. Congratulations, lady. Go Renee!
Yep. So it's actually funny because I think when this episode was coming, I knew who my caryatid was going to be before I knew who my actual lady was going to be. Which is a first.
That is a first.
But I gotta say, I am so happy because Renee is so cool. She is both an urban designer and a master planner. She has degrees from Syracuse, but she also attended the AA in London. She has a master's of science in urban and regional planning from Columbia University as well.
Degrees on degrees on degrees.
Yeah, that's too cool. I couldn't help Googling her, so check this out. She has served not one, not two, not four, not eight, 10 mayors as the urban policy advisor in major U.S. cities like Washington, D.C., New York City, Atlanta, to name a few. And most recently, Birmingham, where she was the director of grants and special projects. Okay. Tell me how I apply for that job, because it sounds great.
I was going to say, this lady is up your alley.
Yes. Yeah. Renee also served as a director of master planning for Birmingham's award-winning Railroad Reservation Park and the innovative Birmingham Civil Rights Heritage Trail. Y'all better believe I'm looking for pictures of that right away.
As you should. I mean, she sounds so cool. And those projects are cool. I've seen them. Okay, so Renee reminds me of Olive because she did all the things, okay? And both of them are so inspiring in everything that they were able to accomplish, ma'am.
Yes, I am definitely feeling the connection.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so before we say see you later, we want to give thanks to CMYK for the music and John W., our technical producer. And most of all, thank all of you listeners out there. Thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of the projects we've talked about.
All right. We hope you've enjoyed learning about Olive, Renee, and the like 2 seconds of Francis, along with our banter, and that you're inspired to find out more about these ladies and other amazing professional ladies out there. Again, thank you.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world.
Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, urban planners, residential architects, designers in political positions, give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify, write us a review. This really helps us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about women and bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on Twitter at shebuildspod. Buy our merchandise at our website. Check out these cool sweaters that we're wearing and t-shirts. All right, until next time, bye!
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 Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability. Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guidepost for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.